Now please turn in the scriptures this evening. We shall take our text from the portion that we read together from Job chapter 23 under verse 10. Job chapter 23 under verse 10 we shall take as our text. But he knoweth the way that I take. When he hath tried me, I shall come forth as gold. These words spoken by the man Job, after he has lost so much, after he has lost almost everything that he possesses, after he has lost even his very health, which has been taken away from him, he has been left destitute of all comforts in this life. Even his wife has turned upon him, and she now is persuading him to do things that he ought not to do. Even after all this, Job proves himself to be a man of God. Job proves himself before the Lord as this trial is put upon him, for he can speak with confidence in the words of our text. He knoweth the way that I take. When he hath tried me, I shall come forth as gold. This has been evident from the very beginning. It was, of course, Satan who stood before the Lord and said to him, "Doth Job serve God for naught? Does he serve you for nothing? Look at all that you do for him." He was a man who was one of the wealthiest men of the East. He was a man who was blessed with so much great substance. 7,000 sheep and 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen and 500 she-asses, and a very great household. This was a man who had been blessed greatly in temporal things. He had got just about everything he could ever want in this world and in this life. He was lacking almost nothing of all that a man could have, it seems, in this world. And so Satan was coming before the Lord, and his argument was thus: you do so much for him. Is it any surprise that he fears you? Is it any surprise that Job fears God when God provides for him all these things that he ever needed? What wonder is it? And the Lord says to him, "Behold, all that he hath is in thy power. Now prove this statement. You have said that if God were to put forth his hand and to touch all that he hath, he will curse thee to thy face. Well, go," he says, "and do it, and see what happens." And what is Job's response? He rent his mantle, shaved his head, and fell to the ground and worshipped, and said, "Naked came I out of my mother's womb, and naked shall I return thither. The Lord gave, the Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." And Satan then takes away his health, and yet he remains just as unmoved in the face of all this. He will be unchanged. Satan sends him these comforters, who are no comforters at all, but come to him most miserably to try to persuade him that he has done something terribly wicked, that he must have done something so, or else all this calamity would never have come upon him. And yet Job continually defends himself. He justifies himself and he justifies God in his defense. And he portrays real religion, but not merely a religion of works, which is true. Now, in the chapter immediately preceding this, chapter 23, there has been various arguments being given by Eliphaz, the Temanite, who was one of these friends, not friends at all, really, but they were men who came to him in his distress and sought to bring him some kind of counsel, we suppose. And he comes, and he now comes to Job with a different line of argument to that which has often come before, that being that he must have done something terribly wrong. And he says, "Well, can a man be profitable unto God? Is it any pleasure to the Almighty that thou art righteous? Did it bring God any satisfaction that you are so holy as you claim yourself to be? You say you're so righteous. You say that you've done all things according to the law of God. You have done all things as he has specified and commanded. But is it any pleasure to God that you are like this?" And he comes with these various arguments. And then he turns to accuse Job and to say that he was not upright and righteous at all. And he says of how he has sinned and accuses him of various sins. He speaks nonetheless truth in what he says in certain places. It is not to say that these men who gave such evil counsel to this suffering and afflicted man, They were not entirely wrong in all that they said. Indeed, it was many good things that he wrote, and yet, nonetheless, the principle of the matter that he gave was flawed. But he speaks of the greatness of God. He speaks of the exaltation of the Almighty, and he seeks to set the Lord as being so holy and so much dwelling on high, which are all right and proper, and it is just as well if we hold such a view of God in our minds as to have him so high and holy. But nonetheless, these things and the accusations that come with them are of no help to Job. But he responds with this self-same confidence that he has continually held about him. He constantly holds this same hope, which he clings to throughout all his distresses and all his struggles. He clings to great trust and faith in God as being the Almighty. Even he has a greater view of God than his friends, though they seek to set God up so high, because he has a view of God which is true, which is by revelation to his soul, whereas these knew it merely from what they had heard. Job knew it. They merely knew of it. And Job comes then with further complaints. Every day is my complaint bitter. My stroke is heavier than my groaning. What is his greatest concern, though? We read this in the second verse. Oh, that I knew where I might find him, that I might come even to his seat. He's speaking of the Lord, no doubt. What a remarkable thing to say. Where can I find the Lord, he is saying, this one who is so great? Even the heaven of heavens cannot contain him. Where shall I find him? What a strange thing to say, we might think. How extraordinary that he should phrase it in such a way. But what was it that he missed? The God who, as it were, fills the whole universe, he was not felt to be close in his soul. And this was his concern. He felt him to be so distant. Though he knew that God was even nigh at hand, he was not far away, so to speak. And yet it felt as though the Lord had removed himself. As he had come and put all these afflictions upon him, as he had permitted Satan's hand to turn against him, even then, such a man as this, he felt that the Lord had withdrawn himself and withdrawn all of his precious comforts to his soul, and he was no longer there. He was no longer warming his soul. He was no longer drawing near. He was no longer granting to him the great blessings of being in Christ. He felt so cold. So miserable. Christ had gone. His beloved had departed and he knew not where he was. Oh, he says, that I knew where I might find him, that I might come even to his seat. Then all would be well. If I could but find him, if he would but draw near again, if I could feel the refreshing influences of his spirit in my soul, then it should be well with me. And yet till then, I shall but desire him. I shall desire him strongly, though. And he shall speak in such a way as this. Plead that the Lord would come. He speaks of his condition in the verses immediately preceding our text. I go forward, he says, but he is not there. Backward, I cannot perceive him. On the left hand, where he doth work, but I cannot behold him. He hideth himself on the right hand, that I cannot see him. Everywhere he looked about him in every direction. He was seeking for the Lord in every place in this condition, desiring that he might find him. He was as the Shulamite in the Song of Solomon, going about the city, asking whether they had seen her beloved. Where, if they knew where he was, where he might be found. And so we see Job here. He looks about him, he looks before, he looks behind, he looks to the right hand and he looks to the left. And yet where is he to be found? He cannot see him. And yet he knows he is there. Surely we read there, on the left hand, he even says he doth work. Even there, I cannot see it. I cannot see a purpose to it. I cannot see his hand in it. It seems perhaps to be an affliction, a trial to me. I cannot see why it is happening, And yet surely I always have this confident assurance that he is working there. It may be that he works behind a shroud. He works behind a veil. It is, as it were, a workman is up on the stage, perhaps a carpenter, designing some great piece, some great work of art that he is carving out of the wood. And yet in front of that stage there is a great curtain, and none in the audience can see until the curtains are drawn back what that great work is. It is being worked on there, secretly and perhaps silently. Is the work taking place? Well, surely it is. But there is no evidence of it. But it is happening. And then at that last day, if not before, when the heavens shall be rolled up as a scroll, those curtains shall be rolled back, and the plan of God's providence shall be revealed with all its glory, in all its beauty, in all the wisdom that attends to it. And it shall be plain, even this very truth which Job clings to here. He knoweth the way that I take. When he hath tried me, I shall come forth as gold. Well, as we come to the text, we see principally here two great doctrines. Two great doctrines. One, if you like, concerning God, and the other concerning man, we shall consider tonight. He knoweth the way that I take. God knoweth all things. Therein lies a great and a grand doctrine. And the second, that man must be sanctified. When he hath tried me, I shall come forth as gold. We shall consider the first to commence. He knoweth the way that I take. God knoweth all things. It is disputed vainly by some that God merely has the ability to know all things. He merely has the ability to find out the information. It is, as it were, accessible to him. My friends, that is nonsense. All things are known to him. Why can we speak of this with confidence? Because all things were decreed by him. And if all things that take place in this life are decreed expressly by the Almighty God, how can it be that he does not know them? But what things? What things were decreed by God? All things. We can say that so easily, can we not? We can believe it so readily. And yet, what does that really mean? What does that actually look like in practice? God knows all things. It means, if I might borrow an illustration I have heard before, that God knows when a petals of a tiny little flower growing in the midst of a forest miles away from human habitation open. No man is there to see it. No man is there to document it or to record the opening of the petals of this tiny flower, which is so insignificant. And if man were to ever venture into such a wilderness, he would perhaps tread it underfoot. And yet God knows when those petals open, and he has decreed that they shall open. This is how minute God's knowledge is of all things. And if God has decreed and ordained at what time the petals of a flower should open in some remote forest, how much more has he decreed all things to do with man? How much more has he decreed all things that must come to pass in the world, from events on the national stage to events on a personal level? How he has decreed everything that must happen to you does not, of course, eliminate responsibility on your part. And nonetheless, he knows it. He has appointed these things for us. Things may come upon us so suddenly. Sometimes something may happen and we may see it as a mere accident. It was so unexpected. Nobody saw it coming. Nobody had anticipated it. And yet it seemed to have just happened. And we know not where it came from. We know not how it happened. But it has happened to us and perhaps caused us much grief, much misery, much disappointment, much sadness. Where did it come from? Can it be that it was the decree of God? For how can it not be so? How can it not be that this was the appointment of God? He knoweth the way that I take, for he hath appointed it beforehand. It is set out, it is laid out for you, and not merely that, but it is very personally set out. We see that he knoweth the way that I take. I've considered something of the minutiae of the matter, but here we see how it is personal to every one. There are many paths in life that we may take. If you were to go for a walk, you might take many different kinds of paths. There might be some which were nicely laid out, flat and smooth and pleasant to walk along. There would be others that were much rougher and much muddier. There would be others which were steep and hilly, others that were slippery. There might be all manner of such things. And yet all these things are merely a picture of the Christian life. To use another illustration, we are soldiers in the army of God, with the captain of our salvation at our head. Now, what is a soldier? He is a man who goes out and fights. But such a man must be used to traversing all manner of different terrains. He cannot merely be one who is used to marching on parade down the streets of London, or else he should not be worthy of the name of a soldier. But no, he must be used to traversing the bogs and the mires. He must be used to going out upon the mountains and bearing hardships and dangers and troubles, watching, sleeping very little, and having such a struggle to continue on, and so being worked to be a hard man who is well able to bear troubles and trials in life. Is the Christian merely a Christian to walk in parade on the streets of London? Is a Christian merely a Christian just to walk along a plateau in the Christian life? No, but there are surely such times as it shall be rough. It shall be seldom that there will be such occasions as the Christian life is easy. It will be seldom that the path is flat and smooth and broad. My friends, this is the way to destruction. The way to destruction is an easy way. It is a broad way. It is a way which does not take much going down, but it is so easy. You can walk it, as it were, without thinking. You take no thought. You have little enough trouble, it seems. You can do it so well. And yet, this narrow path is surely the way of life. And this is the path which the Christian must take. Though it be rough, though it be rugged, though there may be many difficulties along the way, why is it so easy? Why is it easier to bear, and why is it better at the last? Such a man who walks on a broad road, he has no help, for he has no need of help. He does not feel himself to be in any need whatsoever, and so he can walk along. What need has he of any assistance? What need has he of comrades? He has none. And yet the man who is in difficulties, the man who is struggling, the man who is weary, how thankful he is to have a helping hand. My friends, the Christian has Christ. And he has this comfortable assurance as he climbs upon the mountains, as he struggles upon the rough terrain, as he endures trials and hardships and difficulties, that he may be a good soldier of Jesus Christ. He holds on to this firmly. He knoweth the way that I take. I have never passed this way before. I have never been here before. I have never been in this situation before, never encountered this trial before. It is entirely new difficulty to me, a new challenge to me. I am almost going under over it, but he knoweth the way that I take. It is set out for me, and more, it is appointed for me. It is appointed, as we shall consider in a moment, for a special purpose for me. Not merely just appointed with no purpose, but appointed deliberately for me. There is a great end about it. It is not as though such a way was merely decided by the casting of the lot. It was not a random chance that decided what the way of life should be, but it was the decree of God. And therefore, God, being holy and just and perfect in all his ways and all his decrees, surely has decreed all things specifically for us, for our good, for our benefit. It may seem strange, and yet surely it is so. And this is a part of this great promise. He knoweth the way that I take. We shall consider more of the purpose in a moment. And yet these ways may be so hard. It may be such a trial for us to walk along such a way as this. It may be a way which is unfamiliar. I touched on this briefly. It may be a way that is such a burden and a struggle to us. It may bring us so low, cast us down to the ground. The psalmist in Psalm 73 speaks of how his feet had well nigh slipped when he became envious at the wicked. There is a temptation to sin. This besets us on every side. Surely sin and evil is never far from us, but it is always present with us. And this is the apostle's sad lament in Romans 7, when he speaks of the sin that dwells yet within his mortal members, and how he cannot be freed from it, though he longs for such freedom. And he is brought even to so low a condition as to cry out, "O wretched man that I am." This was his path, and it is the path for every one of us in this respect, that we must do battle daily with this sin. Sin which dwells within us. Sin which is, as it were, an ally within the gates. Sin which lets in the enemy in the form of Satan in the world through. And we would love that we might be freed from it. That we might love that we might serve Christ with all our strength, with all our heart and with all our mind, that there might be nothing to hinder us in the service of Christ. How we long for it, but how sin hinders it. That longing is so often put down. It is hindered. It is tripped up. For we fall by the way so often. But the Lord knoweth these things. No excuse to continue in sin. No excuse that we might go on in such a frame, that we might find this to be a reason why we might continue to sin. No. But nonetheless, when we are so grieved over our sin, when we feel ourselves to be so wretched before the Lord, to be in such a state as the psalmist says again in Psalm 73, how that he was so foolish and ignorant. He said, "I was as a beast before thee." Strong language, but not inappropriate. Such is man before his God, who has done so much for him, who does so much for him in merely giving him breath, that he might breathe, and yet he will deny the Lord even, that he might serve him with that. But there are further things. Trials are not all brought on by sin, and trials are not all sin. Job's was no trial because of his sin, and yet it was that temporal struggles and difficulties come upon us. Nonetheless, is this way unknown to the Lord? Of course not. But surely he brings them upon us to try us, that we might come forth as gold. It may be sometimes as though we are so burdened by certain things that take place. We are so afflicted by certain trials which come upon us, trials which we can scarcely escape from, trials which we never expected. And yet, great grief of mind to us. There are many cases of these that we find in the scriptures. We find many who carried such a burden about with them all their days. It was not the result of sin immediately. It was, of course, to some extent, the result of sin being in the world, else there should have been no imperfection in the world whatsoever. But nonetheless, it was not the result directly of sin. We see how that Esau's wives were a grief of mind to Isaac and Rebekah. And we see many further cases in the scriptures of how that after sin even has been committed, The Lord has brought trials upon his people to keep them humble. What of David? We find him in a sad case after he has committed that sin with Bathsheba, and after he has killed Uriah and committed all that great chain of sins which followed in the wake of that. What do we find of him after this? He has no end of afflictions, no end of problems in the family. His sons, two of them, rise up against him at different times and seek to take the kingdom from him. He loses, of course, his first son by Bathsheba. The Lord blesses him with the second, who is, of course, Solomon. But all through his life, then, it is, as it were, he almost goes back to what he was before he became a king. We often find him a fugitive. We often find him in despair and distress. What of that? Was that not appointed? Surely it was. Surely these things were all appointed of the Lord. He knew well what it was when he commanded that man to curse David when he was on the run. Surely it was viewed as a great evil. It was a great affliction to David to hear this man blaspheming and cursing him in such a vile way. And yet it was appointed of the Lord. He knoweth the way that I take. But what must our response be to this? We see so great a doctrine. We see just a mere glimpse of the extent of it. But what of it, you might say? It's all very well to believe something, and we might very well believe in a doctrine, and yet it never make any impact on us whatsoever, or make any change to us for that matter. We can say that we believe that something is the case, and yet it doesn't affect what we do from day to day. Well, what of this? What do we make of this? When we are given trials of the Lord, when he comes upon us in such a way as is rough and hard and causes us great distress in some way or another, if we have fallen, what is our duty towards the Lord? But is it not constantly to seek his face? Is it not constantly to patiently submit under these trials and to constantly look to him from whose hand they come? Is it not our duty even that we might cry out with Job, cold-hearted and struggling though we may be, laboring and burdened under whatever grief or sin or iniquity it may be in our minds, even to come with Job and to be consistently crying out, oh, that I knew where I might find him, that he might draw near again, repenting of such sin as may have been committed at the time, and yet seeking him earnestly and desperately and urgently. It may be hard to do so at such a time as this. It may be that when we are so cast down and discouraged in our minds, it is a hardship to come before the Lord. It is a chore to pray, a chore to read the scriptures, even for a believer in Jesus Christ, a chore even to hear the ministry of the word, a chore to partake of any of the ordinances appointed by God for Christian growth. And yet it is somewhat ironic that when we are least disposed to them, we need them most. When we are least disposed towards ordinances, least inclined to pray, least desiring to read and to study the scriptures, even at such times as that, we are in most need of them. Then we are at such a dangerous time that we will fall away from the Lord, that we will not seek his face, that we will fail to seek him out, that we should be even in such a state that should lead to prolonged misery, prolonged grief, for we sought not out the Lord. If we were to speak outside of the providence of God for a moment, we might consider how much pain and torment of the soul could have been spared if we had but turned sooner to the Lord when we were cold-hearted, if we had not continued so long thinking that we were all right, thinking that we could get by, thinking that we would manage somehow, and that one day when we felt like it, we would return to these things. Once the Lord had inclined our hearts back to them again, that then we would be able to engage again, and then we would focus on these things again. But for the present, we would neglect them. How much grief might have been spared if we had have turned the sooner to the Lord. How much grief that could have been averted. How much suffering, how much anguish, how much pain yet could have been avoided if we had but sought the Lord. Do we suppose that these men of God who speak so passionately of desiring the Lord and desiring his presence, do we suppose that they were constantly warm-hearted at these times? They were constantly in a good frame at that time in their minds? Do we suppose that they were constantly always desiring to know the Lord and desiring to be closer to him, desiring his presence? They were not. But this drove them to it. This drove them to cry out so earnestly as they do, because they felt themselves to be so cold. They felt themselves to be so lost without Christ and so much without hope that they saw in him all their hope. And so they were caused to cry out as they do. Even at such a time as this, prayer might have seemed to Job to be an empty thing. It seemed as though his prayers never ascended beyond the ceiling because he could not find him. It was, as it were, as though access had been denied him. He was barred from heaven. He could not get there. His prayers never reached thence. And yet the Christian, he must constantly have such a desire in his heart, and he must persist at his duties. And in persisting at his duties, he shall surely find grace. So he is instructed, the Christian believer, to come boldly to the throne of grace, that there he may obtain help and strength and grace in time of need. He is instructed to come boldly, not just when he feels like it, but constantly, to come boldly, always, never fearing that he will be turned away, for he cannot. The Lord will not turn away his own. The Lord knoweth all men. He knoweth the ways of all men, but surely he has a special care for his people. He has a special eye upon his chosen ones. He will never turn them away. They may be long knocking at the door, but they must continue there, and he shall answer. Well, so much for this first doctrine. The Lord knows all things. He knoweth the way that I take. Let us just consider for a few moments this second portion. When he hath tried me, I shall come forth as gold. And here we see something of the purpose which the Lord has in all these things, in bringing all these trials upon us, in bringing us through certain seasons of anguish and grief and misery and heaviness of soul. It is all a trial. All a trial of faith. We find that Peter speaks of this in his epistle. He speaks of the trial of the believer's faith, but being much more precious than of gold that perisheth, though it be tried with fire, might be found under praise and honor and glory at the appearing of Jesus Christ. And such is what is spoken of here. The language used here, a trial of faith, and the reference, of course, to gold, as it is, if you like, expounded in the portion in Peter, it shows to us something of the extent of the suffering. This is a fire which burns hot. A fire which burns and therefore is extremely painful. We are speaking undoubtedly in some cases of extreme suffering and torment and trouble. The psalmist again speaks of the waters going over his soul. He He speaks of being in such a condition as it is, as it were, as though he is drowning. So desperate does his case feel. We read in Isaiah of the Lord speaking and saying that he will be with his people when they go through the water and when they go through the fire, yet he shall be with them. As I have said, the way that he takes is a fiery way. It is not an easy way, but it is a hard way. But it has one grand purpose. It is a limited trial, we might note. When he hath tried me, it infers to us that there is an end to this trial. It is not an everlasting trial. It is not an eternal trial. For else that would have no end. There would be no purpose to the trial. But yet this is a limited time, whence there shall be trials, and it is the duration of our lives upon this earth. Here we shall have tribulation and trials, yet for the believer in Jesus Christ in glory, we shall have rest, an eternal rest. But this trying, it must continue all our days. It will vary in degrees, no doubt. It will at times, the flames will burn warmer than at others. At times it will seem as though we are almost consumed by them, that we can scarce live another day. We can scarcely get through another moment, but we must be consumed. And yet such a trial as this, he is confident in. Surely Job had a trial of something of a great intensity. Surely this was an occasion when the flames were heated 7 times hotter. Surely this was an occasion when his faith was truly tried. And there are many in the scriptures when we can read of such things. Think of the great agony that it must have been for Abraham when he was instructed to sacrifice his only son Isaac. What a trial that was. What trials the Apostle Paul must pass through, as documented in 2 Corinthians 11. We read there of such a great list of difficulties that he passed through, difficulties of every shape and kind, difficulties that he had physically, difficulties that he struggled with from opposition and persecution, difficulties that he had with his own body in weariness and hungering and tiredness and the like that he speaks of there. He speaks of natural problems that arise for him, of shipwrecks and all the like. These men were tried, so shall we be tried. All manner of things shall come to us. All manner of things shall come upon us of these natures. They will not merely be things spiritual. They will not merely be things of persecution. But it will be all troubles in life. They will each come to us as trials. But they each have a formative work. We err if we think upon these things negatively. We err if we fall into such a state of bemoaning our lot, bemoaning why all these troubles have come upon us. Because this is the unseen carpenter's work behind the curtain. This is such a work that is formed in us. Wood does not have feelings, but nonetheless, one would imagine it would be painful to have chips taken off, to lose parts, to have bits chipped away. My friend, so it is with us. But what is the purpose? What is it that is being formed? With all the pain of all these parts being taken away, surely it is the image of Christ that is being formed in our hearts. By these things, surely we see how that in us, the image of Christ is being formed. Whilst we endure all these trials and these troubles, then it is that we are being made conformed to the image of Christ. And this is what the apostle speaks of. It is quoted so often, it almost becomes a cliche in this context. All things work together for good. Why? How? That we be conformed to the image of Christ. We find it in the very next verse. He speaks of this. Verses 28 and 29 of Romans chapter 8. Surely this is the grand purpose. My friends, we must look to profit from these things. We must look that in all these troubles and trials that come upon us, yet that we may grow as Christian people. That we may by these things be forced, compelled to fly to Jesus Christ. That as we experience these things, we may see the passing and fallible nature of all things in this world and look rather to the glory which is to come, the eternal perfection of heaven and of Christ, who is the chief glory therein. That must be our aim. That must be our goal in all these troubles in this life. And all the way, we have the company of Christ. Yet his image is imperfect in each of us. Yet we still will fall into sin. And yet not only he knoweth the way that we take, he hath appointed it. But more, Christ is our high priest. He intercedes for us all along the way. And even Christ draws near to us whilst we are yet on the road to Zion. Let us be confident in this, my friends. When trials afflict us in this life, when we endure suffering and struggles of every kind, of every nature, let us rest in this one sure comfort and assurance. He knoweth the way that I take. When he hath tried me, I shall come forth as gold. Well, may the Lord bless these things to our souls tonight. For Christ's sake. Amen.